Thank you for the very special music and also the offertory by Mr. Harmon. It is a distinct pleasure to see him. He was working diligently over the past summer to try to get his fingers to obey, and I think he's doing quite well. We appreciate that. Also, we're blessed with additional musical talent. Sophia Del Sonori, I lost no time in talking to her about bringing her talents to bear here in North Canton, so she'll be playing piano, as will Vincent will as well. I gave him a little bit of a challenge and a goal to work towards, so we've missed our piano playing over the course of, well, how long has it been now? Almost a year to one extent, because the Wieners left right after the feast and moved to eastern Pennsylvania. This afternoon, I'd like to ask all of us an important question. Are you under the influence? Or perhaps I could frame the question a little bit differently. Have you ever been under the influence? Now, normally we associate the term under the influence to the consumption of alcohol, which I'll tip you off, that's not the topic of the sermon today, but it introduces it well. And alcohol is one of the items that challenges our ability to act in moderation, to enjoy something that God created, that Jesus Christ actually created by miracle as his first one. So it's something very good on the one hand and something very bad on the other. So it challenges us to act in moderation, to exercise self-control. And even Paul, in his admonition and instruction to Timothy, instructed him to use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. You know, used in moderation. Alcohol is a beverage with health benefits, both physically and psychologically. However, when we allow ourselves to come under its influence, instead of exercising self-control, it becomes very destructive. A destructive force impairing our judgment, blurring our vision, and hampering our motor skills. I almost said murder skills. I guess it could lead to that as well. You have to forgive me because I can't reach to my glass of orange juice this afternoon, so my tongue right now feels a little bit like sandpaper. Okay, consider these facts from Brad21.org, and that's a website that's dedicated to an individual named Bradley who died on his 21st birthday because he overconsumed and died of alcohol poisoning, and also the DUI Foundation. After the consumption of just 2 to 3 drinks for women and 3 to 4 for men, judgment and self-control are reduced, and you believe you are functioning better than you really are. I remember an incident where actually one of my cousins was drinking way too much, and I cautioned him, and he told me he drives better when he drinks. Fortunately, nothing bad happened, and just for the record, I was not driving with him, okay? I saw him in a situation and tried to talk some sense into him. It didn't seem to work. Typical behaviors in this condition include lack of inhibition, extroversion, and seeking sexual pleasure. If you up it to 4 to 5 drinks for men and 3 to 4 for women, there is a significant impairment of our motor coordination and a loss of judgment. Typical behaviors that are existed in this elevated alcohol level include overexpression, slurred speech, and loud disruptive actions. I mean, it kind of fits the bill of the happy or the disruptive drunk. The destructive influence then, you know, from there it goes downhill. I think I've told you before about the brilliant product engineer I once met and had a relationship with, and he confided in me. I have this uncanny ability of people telling me everything I didn't want to know about their lives at the airport when I'm standing in line. I don't know why. Apparently I look like an easy target, but it was a customer. He took me out to dinner to confide in me about his alcohol problem, from which he had recovered. And he told me, to my great surprise, I didn't know much about alcoholism at the time, that he said, "John, I've been dry for," and he gave me the years I don't remember. And this was a brilliant man, just off the charts brilliant. He said, "If I have one drink, I will be on the street in a gutter in a week." And it was like, really? Unfortunately, that story had a very unhappy ending. All of a sudden, he was no longer with the company, and I found out later that he had taken that one drink and made true on his prophecy. So it goes from bad to worse. But as I mentioned, my topic today is not alcoholism, but rather an intoxicating influence of a different sort that often leads to alcoholism. Its effects are no less debilitating, and its grip no less addictive, and its ultimate result the same, namely death. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. We're talking about the intoxicating nature of the influence of Satan. And when you consider what is written here in Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, I remember when I first came into the church and read this, I thought, this is impossible. Notice in verse 9, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world." If you talk about influence and deception of grand proportions, the Bible asserts that all have been deceived by Satan and are under his influence. So when we think that we are not influenced, we're kidding ourselves. We are. It's a matter of degrees. But Satan managed by his intoxicating influence to deceive the entire world. Continuing, "He was cast to earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down.'" That's an interesting statement of fact. Satan accuses us day and night before God. And I would dare say, at least in my case, he probably has a pretty good case every day. But that's part of his strategy. Now let's go over to Revelation chapter 17, and you'll notice the alcohol analogy continues in connection with this deception. Backtracking to what I just said, the statement here is that Satan has deceived the entire world, not just the weak, not just the poor, also the powerful, maybe more so in some cases. That's what we read in Revelation chapter 17, verse 1. "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornications, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.'" That is strong delusion that has come to an extent, but will come at an even greater extent as the end of time approaches. And it is my sense, at least, that we are living in a time of great delusion, and that Satan is hard at work to deceive the many. How else can you explain the irrational things that are going on and being reported in the news? We'll see more about that later. But notice here that they were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Isn't it interesting? And if you will remember, I said that alcohol is one of those things that on the one hand is beneficial. I mean, one drink with a meal lifts your spirits. And then, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you can kill yourself or, you know, if you move back through the spectrum, it cause all kinds of addictive behaviors that I described in part. But isn't it interesting that in the Bible, on the one hand, we have wine as a symbol of Jesus Christ's blood, arguably the most beneficial agent ever given to us. And on the other, here in Revelation, the same substance is used to describe fornication and deception. I think it is an apt connection that we see that is consistent with what we see with the substance itself, namely alcohol or wine. It's very beneficial. It's been proven and documented, you know, that red wine, for example, has certain coronary benefits, and so forth. But even in the Bible, we have the whole spectrum. Dropping down in Revelation chapter 17, verse 6, and I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints. So here you see it used in a still different way. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. This woman is false religion and deception that already exists, but will be existing at a grander scale as we approach and closer to the end time. Now let's go back to Jeremiah chapter 51. I just wanted to quote a couple of scriptures to show, according to the Bible, the state of the world. Jeremiah chapter 51. In verse 7, Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, therefore the nations are deranged. Babylon has suddenly fallen and been destroyed. Wail for her, take balm for her pain, perhaps she may be healed. This sounds just like the passage that we're going to turn to in Revelation. Jeremiah prophesied in his time of what we read back in Revelation chapter 18. Revelation chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So here you see a prophecy of the fulfillment of what Jeremiah prophesied many centuries prior to Jesus Christ giving this revelation to John. Continuing, the kings of earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So that's the state of the world. Clearly, under Satan's influence and sway, they are, as is the title of my sermon, under the influence. Their blood alcohol content of this sort is way high. And their judgment has been impaired, their vision blurred, and their motor skills shackled. It is a dynamic that is universal. That happens. Actions have consequence. I have another story. I found an example of a young man that drove drunk and ended up killing his younger brother. I mean, just a horrible situation. He ended up doing 6 years and then came out to do a ministry to try to reach out and help people in that situation. His operative word is drunk driving is not an accident. It's a choice. The world inadvertently has made a choice to be influenced by and under the sway of Satan. They're deceived, but still a choice. The question is, what about us? Notice what we find in the very next verse in context, verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. Our determination must be, today and on every other day, to be coming out from under the influence that is so pervasive in our world and the activities that are espoused. I mean, it's an apt analogy, isn't it? You know, we live in a country where my name has been misused to designate party time, and it's called what? Miller time, right? I've always thought, you know, if I could just get a small, fractional, 4-5 decimal place commission for the use of my name on alcohol, we could really preach the gospel. But it's instructive. It's instructive because what our world deems as fun and entertainment is actually addictive behavior in most cases that leads to terrible consequences, and we've been called to come out. To come out because if we don't, we will share the same consequence. So let's take a look at three things and then an antidote for it. Three things that those who come under the influence of Satan suffer from. The number one is impaired judgment. We begin to make choices, or people make choices that make no sense, that are illogical, that are to their own hurt in most cases. Romans chapter 1, I can think of no better passage of Scripture to illustrate impaired judgment than what we read right here. Breaking into the context of verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. When you think about this influence, has Satan managed to deceive the whole world on this issue? Pretty much so. Because our public education system, or higher education in general, has been so swayed by the influence of Satan that the notion of a creator can no longer be taught. And yet Paul says that they're inexcusable because his, meaning God's, invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. I mean, I believe, and this is personal opinion, nothing more, I believe that evolution will at some point go down into the dustbin of history as one of the dumbest scientific theories to ever have been given the light of day. And, you know, we look at things, and when you look at history, these kinds of phenomena happen. You know, we look back and kind of are amazed or poke fun at the fact that, you know, even as late as the Civil War, the knowledge of what germs and cross-contamination can do when practicing medicine, surgery in particular, was not known. I mean, the way that field surgeons during the Civil War did their things, it would be unthinkable today. I believe at some point, if things continue, the evidence of creation is going to be so compelling that evolution will be made out for the deception that it has been. Continuing in verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. You see, when we fail to recognize the sheer marvel of creation, from the flower to you and I that God created, it does something to our minds, especially when we not only deny it, but we replace it with the lie of happenstance and circumstance, namely evolution. And we become foolish because our minds are no longer functioning logically and clearly. Continuing, professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. The consequence of poor judgment in the absence of God. And it gets worse. Continuing, for this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men, committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which is due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And yet, today we need to speak openly about this. What 10, 20 years ago you wouldn't have done because it would have been shameful. And yet, alternative lifestyles, what is being described here, has progressed to the point where it is being defended by those who profess to be Christian under the all-encompassing love of God. And somehow they have bought into the deception. They have been influenced to the point where their judgment is so impaired that they can no longer differentiate between lust and love. It has an intoxicating effect. And the consequence just comes. It's unavoidable. It's like the law of gravity. The second point is blurred vision. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I'll tell you a little story from my youth about blurred vision with respect to alcohol. among the Amish, at least when I was growing up, alcohol was for medicinal purposes. So we had dandelion wine in the basement, and we had Jack Daniels in the pantry for medicinal purposes. And I was once told that if you have a really, really bad cold, what you do is you take a black hat and a Jack Daniels, and go to your bedroom and hang the black hat on a nail on the wall and tip the bottle until your vision is sufficiently blurred that you see two hats. And then you were supposed to sleep, not that you wouldn't have done it at that point. And that was supposed to cure any cold. Now, I will put a qualifier on this. Don't try this at home. Okay? It's just an illustration of blurred vision. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 through 4. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose mind the God of this world, God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine upon them. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves for your servants for Jesus' sake. So here Paul differentiates between those upon whom the light of the gospel has shone. You know, when you start looking at the truth, clarity occurs. And clarity of vision is given to you, both physically and spiritually. Spiritually, because the light of the glorious gospel of Christ has had an impact on you. And physically, because you can think logically. You know, those that are under the influence think that Miller time is the life. It's presented to us this way. You know, ever notice, you know, alcoholic beverages and Coca-Cola and all of those. Have you ever seen how happy those people are in those ads? I mean, they're just, it's the good life. Have you ever taken the time to then observe people that actually practice what they're preaching to see whether they are as good looking and as healthy and as vigorous as those people in the advertisement? Whether it's alcohol or the lesser of the evils, you know, carbonated drinks that are loaded with sugar like Coca-Cola. People that do consume large quantities of those things typically don't look like what is advertised. They've been had. They've been deceived. Their vision has been blinded. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 17. Here he's writing to the Ephesian church, and he says this: "This I say, therefore, testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of their ignorance that is in them, because of the hardening of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over to licentiousness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. But you have not so learned Christ." You see, this kind of lifestyle is what the world thinks is their idea of a great weekend. But Paul said, apparently the Ephesians were having those kinds of issues. Paul said that you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth as in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts, to be renewed in the spirit of your mind. It's not what we are supposed to be about. Point number three. Those under the influence have shackled motor skills. You know, you've probably seen people in shackles, slaves, enslaved, and their motor skills are, their mobility is limited. You know, they can't go very far very fast. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you have the chain gang crew, and their mobility is shackled even further. Let's go over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8, verse 32, speaks to this. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. You know, that's a principle that I never cease to be amazed at its, pardon the pun, truism. The truth just tends to kind of come out. You know, I'm much more relaxed in that regard because I've just seen that over the years. You just give it time. The best way to convict a liar is to believe their lies. Because sooner or later, it becomes really interesting because, you know, you write it all down and you write it all down and, oh, okay, well, you said this. Well, what about on this date and on at this time you said that? You know, that's when it gets interesting. And they become shackled in their motor skills. They're unable to move and maneuver. Notice in verse 33, they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say we will be made free?" I always think, I read this and it just sounds like Joe Smith American, you know, with his six pack and his pickup truck tailgating at a football game and saying, "What do you mean? We are enslaved. We are under the influence." As we live in the land of the free. I mean, so it is with the influence of Satan. It is so cunning that most people think they are free when in fact they are enslaved. Verse 34, Jesus answers the question, "Most assuredly I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin, and a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever." So what to do about it? You know, what if the influence is so pervasive? Satan's influence is pervasive. I mean, that's undeniable because of what the Bible said. All have been deceived. If that be so, and if we are commanded to come out of this world, what tools are at our disposal to do that? Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 12. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." You know, we're being accused by Satan himself. We read that. At the very throne of God, and usually rightly so. Because, you know, Satan knows us, and he does not recognize the validity of Christ's shed blood. So, you know, he can build his case. "That's with whom we are wrestling." We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. That's a fact. Now, what to do? Therefore, Paul writes to the Ephesians, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. These are described, these activities are described as armor. Preaching the gospel is like shoes on a soldier, Paul says. Righteousness is like a breastplate of protection. Your commandments are righteousness, God said. And continue in verse 16, above all, taking the shield of faith with which you are able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Faith, like the warrior of old, is able to protect us from the fiery darts that the wicked one shoots at us. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all saints and for me, that utterance may be given to me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that in it I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. Isn't it interesting that he requested not an escape from prison, but rather to speak more boldly? It's a powerful antidote, isn't it? It's equipment, tools, protective in nature to help us fight against what is described here as the wiles of the devil. And this day more than any other represents a time when that influence will be squelched. We celebrate it under God's instruction by afflicting our souls. And it's the afternoon and we're kind of afflicted of soul. And I'd like to now go to Isaiah chapter 58, because this is the classic passage regarding fasting. And it describes, in a very poignant way, just how powerful this tool is in squelching Satan's influence. As I wrote this morning to all of you, we're celebrating a day that looks to the present and the future. The putting away, of Satan has both present and future benefits. Benefit in the future, most certainly, because Satan will be restrained for 1,000 years. Benefit in the present, that to the extent that we armor ourselves and engage in what this day commands us to do, we can already greatly reduce his influence on us. Oh, that we could completely squelch his influence. But I almost think the notion that if we ever get to the point where we think we have Satan is not influencing us at all, that's probably the height of deception, because that probably means that he influenced us in that way to let down our guard. But fasting is a way for us to take a strong offensive action against the influence of Satan. And we see that here recorded in Isaiah chapter 58. Cry aloud and spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, tell my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sin. Yeah, that's always been the duty of those that have been asked to speak. How many of you know Tom Wilson? Probably about everybody here. I'll tell on him today, on my friend. I came to Mansfield as a guest speaker. This has probably been 10 years ago. And Tom comes up to me and pats me on the back and said, "Well, John, you going to cry aloud and spare not today?" And I said, "Well, Tom, I hadn't thought about it, but if you think you need it, I might be able to do that for you." That was just a joke on his part. But Isaiah was instructed to cry aloud and spare not and tell the people their transgressions for a particular purpose. Verse 2, "Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask me of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching God." You know, this is the wonderful accomplishment of Satan, is if he can get somebody to the point where they think they're delighting in the Lord, while at the same time doing something completely contrary. "Why," they say, "have we fasted, and you have not seen? Why have we afflicted our souls, and you take no notice? In fact, in the day of your fast, you find pleasure and exploit all your laborers." So they were exploiting their people at the same time that they were fasting. "Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and to strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day, to make your voice heard on high. Is it a fast that I have chosen, a day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head like a bulrush, to spread out sackcloth and ashes?" And that's reminiscent of what Jesus Christ criticized the Pharisees to do. "Would you call this a fast, an acceptable day of the Lord?" The Lord asks. And then in verse 6, he gets to the point. "Is this not the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you may break every yoke?" Those are powerful promises. That fasting, afflicting of soul, is able with God's help to accomplish. Bonds of wickedness, addictions, habits that compel us to do things we know we shouldn't, to undo heavy burdens. You know, if you have burdens that are just too difficult to bear, fasting has the capacity to undo it. If you are yoked, to something that takes you in a direction that you do not willingly want to go or should not be going, fasting is able to break that yoke. Verse 7, is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. You see, there is a mindset and behavior that is either consistent or inconsistent with the act of fasting. You know, the Pharisees fasted. I mean, they had it down pat. They did sackcloth and ashes. And they made sure everybody knew about it, too. Jesus Christ instructed us to not let anybody know when we fast, to wash ourselves, to not appear as to be fasting in order to have the real effect, and behave in a manner consistent with the giving and sharing and mercy that Christ exhibited. Then notice in verse 8 the result. Then your light shall break forth like the morning, and your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. And if you look at, you know, here on this day, there are many thousands of people afflicting their souls. It is a fast that the Lord has chosen that enables us to enjoy the freedom of not being under the influence presently, and pictures the time in which Satan will be bound and his influence will no longer be going around the world. And I don't think we can even begin to comprehend the difference that will make. The morning will break forth speedily. Yokes will be broken. It is a monumental day when you think about it. You know, Jesus Christ returns as symbolized by the Day of Trumpets. But if you read in Revelation, Satan being bound with a chain for 1,000 years, I mean, it's kind of, you know, which one is more significant? That's what we're celebrating today. That's what we're pausing to ponder for 24 hours. A peace and calm, no distractions with eating and drinking. Matthew chapter 17. Notice here what Jesus Christ said. Matthew chapter 17. We have the story here of the let's go back to verse 17. In verse 15, you know, there was a guy that came and had asked for mercy for his son because he was epileptic, and the disciples couldn't cure him. Jesus wasn't that, You know, I always try to put myself in the disciples' shoes, you know. They were out there trying to heal people, and they were unsuccessful. And apparently Jesus didn't go to the school of, you know, buttering people up, you know. Well, I mean, okay, you have to understand, you know, the disciples are just learning. You know, they're still in training. We'll get them some more training. You know, Christ said, "Oh, faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and he came out of him, and the child was cured at that very hour. Then the disciples came to him privately and said, "Why could we not cast him out?" So, I mean, there was training to be done. So Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief, for assuredly I say to you, if you had the faith of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." And then here's the point I wanted to get to. Verse 21, "However, this kind does not come out except by prayer and fasting." Highlighting the power of what we are doing today. We are most powerful when we feel powerless. It is when we give that we get. It is when we have want that often we feel the most blessed. Revelation chapter 20. Verse 1, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years were finished, but after these things he must be released for a little while." That will make a monumental difference. It will be like, you know, to continue the analogy, the drunk that finally comes to his senses and sobers up. The world will be sober, no longer intoxicated by the wine of the fornication of which we read earlier. We conclude over in Revelation chapter 12, where we started, with some very good news. We read, verse 9, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world." That's depressing. "He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who has accused them before our God day and night has been cast down.'" That's good news for heaven. It's bad news for earth. But we haven't read the end of the story. The good news is in the next verse. "And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil comes down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." The good news is that we can and have overcome by the blood of the Lamb. That is our most powerful agent. And it's interesting that the same substance is described as the agent of overcoming, as well as the agent of intoxication. So we need to be careful from which bar we drink.